every team, regardless of how many years experience they had, they all thought the same way, and none of them, no exceptions, could describe the actual player experience in a way that makes sense of a psychological or robustness. People were saying, they hired me because I'm really good at what I do, and then they took it all away from me by telling me exactly what to do that morning. It is the number one problem, statistically, in the games industry. This is not a problem that's number 10 on the list. If you want a successful studio or game, this is the thing you would work on to give yourself the best chance. The idea of focusing on someone's ability as a metric of building a good team is insane. There's very little research that would support that idea. It's weak at best. And I realized that was the wrong question. The question isn't, why am I seeing this? The question is, why isn't the game industry seeing this?
How does game vision impact studio success? What do you learn when you study successful versus failing studios for a long time? Why do we struggle so much with setting a clear vision within our game studios? Today, we've got Graham McAllister returning to the podcast. Graham has been studying game vision across the games industry and has finished his research. I want to talk about what he's learned. Graham, it is great to talk to you again. We've already been going even before this podcast kicked off. How are you doing?
Ben, I am great. Thank you. And thank you for inviting me back for part three of Game Vision.
Absolutely. Dude, I love it.
Would you believe it? The third installment of this problem.
I know you wanted to do a little bit of a recap just to get us up to speed. But before we do that, can you just quick introduce yourself for the people who haven't heard the previous ones? Just 30 seconds on who you are.
Okay, so I'm Graham McAllister. Hello. I'm an organizational psychologist. Organizational psychology is the branch of science that deals with team performance. So what makes one team perform well and one team perform not so well? Team or organization? Me in particular, I focus on game vision. So for the last 5 years, since 2019, the single question that I've been trying to answer is, what is it that prevents a team from aligning on a clear vision? And I've designed two things that try and help with that problem. Very quickly, one's the game vision alignment check, which is your team aligned? Spoiler alert, the answer is probably not. And then in the last year, since we talked, I designed the game vision blueprint, which is, if you're not aligned, what way can we capture or define game vision that is more accurate? So one is proving, are you aligned or not? And then the most latest thing is, hey, if we're not aligned, what should we be writing down and communicating to get a clear vision? And that's the game vision blueprint. And that's where we are right at this moment, February 2025.
Where did we leave off last time? We were talking a lot. I'll say from my perspective, I think we were diving into this idea that if there's a number one problem you and I both see, it's that games and game teams struggle with game vision, with creating an aligned picture of where they're trying to go. You've been working with a lot of studios. I've been working with a lot of studios. It is one of the most consistent things. One of the biggest things I would, when I go into a company, it's one of the first things I'm looking for, honestly, is, do you know what your game is together collectively? Because if one person thinks this thing or one person thinks that thing or nobody knows what it is or everybody's just focusing on stuff, that's going to inhibit any chance of success way more than people realize.
Yeah. So let's start there. So I mentioned when we last talked, June last year, so people can find that podcast. I think it went online in July. So if you look for July 25, 24, you'll find that. Why did I go back to the London School of Economics to study organizational psychology? So I mentioned there's two tools or exercises I created for game vision. The game vision alignment check started in 2019, and it addresses the problem you just mentioned. You go into a studio, you ask them, are they aligned? Broadly, you get two different answers. Some people say, yes, we're very good at game vision. We're definitely aligned. And I got frustrated by that because I knew that's probably not true. And you know it's not true because if I was allowed to walk around the studio, I would ask people, like, do you have a clear set understanding of the game's vision? And usually the answer was no. So the higher-ups think yes. The people, the followers usually think no. But I wanted to prove that to everybody. So I did that 80 times around the world with game studios, nearly 80 times now. And I think I said in the last podcast, no team has been aligned. It has never happened. And it is independent of your experience and everything like that. It is a psychological problem. It's how you think. So I had the results that said, no team is going to be aligned. And I had the tool that proved it. I spent 5 years making it. It's called a mental model deconstructor. It takes what's inside your head and your colleague's head and your colleague's head. And it surfaces up what you're thinking, what's not being said, brings it to the surface, and visualizes it and we compare it. And it's, oh, who knew? Now we can fix it. What led me back to LSE, London School of Economics, was why does that happen? Now that we know it happens, what's going on in our heads? So it's called your mental model. When you think of your game, that's called your mental model. I'm going to introduce quite a lot of terms tonight, not to bore people with academic nonsense, but just in case they want to look up the in more detail what we're talking about, or this is the word you would look up to understand these problems better. So the problem I went back to LSE was, what is stopping people, games teams, aligning on their vision? I knew it was happening. So the 5 years before that proved that out. But nobody knew. There was no previous research that I could just look up and go, how do game creators think? So for all of 2024, my master's dissertation was on game vision. It's called something like The Sense-Making Processes and Mental Models of Game Creators. So that's the official title. And I'm going to describe all that means. Hey, what's sense-making? What's mental models or shared mental models? By the end of this podcast, you'll know what all that means. And you'll also understand why it's important, right? So that's the sort of stuff we're going to get into. But that was the question. I needed to understand what's going on. And before you start any research project, and I should say as well, I was a professor in the university, at University of Sussex. So I was a professor in human-computer interaction. So I was already familiar with player psychology, but this is team psychology and it's different. That's why I had to go back to plug a gap in my education. They are not the same. I was missing something. This problem, normally when you start a research project, you have to first of all look to see who else has solved the problem. What else has been done? So it's called your literature review. Yeah, you don't want to just reinvent the wheel. The game industry loves reinventing the wheel, but academics are not meant to reinvent the wheel. You're meant to look and see, hey, before I answer this question, has anyone else done it? And if they have done it, how far have they got? So I looked for different terms like mental models and design, mental models and creativity, all that type of stuff. There is no previous work on game creators. And by game creator, I mean anybody involved in the team, from QA to design to CFO. If you're on a team making a game, I use the term game creator. I do not care what position you're in. You are on the team. You're part of that team contributing to solving that problem. So that's one thing to take away from this already. If somebody wants to type into Google or any academic database, how do game creators think when they think about their game? There is zero research on that problem. So this work that came out of what I did will be the first paper that says, if you want to know how game creators think in 2025 or 2026, that work will be publicly, I hope publicly available somewhere, where you will see what people are thinking for the first time in the game industry.
I love it. Now, dude, it's so cool.
So that's one thing to say, is that this is novel research. This is not something that's repeating or something that's existed for years. However, what I would say is I think people anecdotally have seen evidence of what I found in their day-to-day life. They see the friction. They see that people aren't aligned on a vision. So they're seeing parts of the problem. They're living it and they're feeling it. But what we need is academic rigor that proves it out, because it could just be anecdotal. Somebody could have said, I saw it in my studio, and somebody else could say, I didn't see it. And then we're at stalemate. It's just down to people's opinion. So that's why you do academic research. It tries to remove the bias of one person saying, I think we're fine, and somebody else saying, no, it's a problem. We're trying to figure out, is it true or not? That's the work I was doing. Okay,
perfect.
So that was the problem.
You mentioned, I think you put this on LinkedIn as well, what you discovered was even more extreme than you expected. Yep. You expected there to be no real aligned vision within the studios you found. But what you actually came out with was, when you actually went and did the study, you were like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. Even I, looking at this and thinking, this isn't right, it's even more not right, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
And so talk to me about that. What was surprised you about that?
I was shocked. So I'm going to first of all tell you the two questions. Whenever you start a research project, you have to be very clear on the questions you're asking. So I'm going to tell you the two questions I set out to ask. So they're called RQs, research questions. RQ1, research question one, was what do the mental models of game creators look like? So imagine I go into a studio and I ask the, lead designer, tell me about your game. They're going to start talking about something and I'm interested in that model in their head. So that's the first thing we're interested in exploring. What do the models even look like? When people talk about their game, what do they say? And how do they structure the things? I'm going to tell you all the technical terms for this in a second. So I'm starting off vague, then we'll get into the weeds of what's actually going on in people's heads here. But that's the first question. What do the models look like? When you think about your game, What is that? Second question, RQ2, research question two, said, once we know what they look like, are they any good? And I put on LinkedIn, not only are they no good, they're way worse than I thought. I was doing the research because the previous 5 years I designed that vision alignment check, which says, I know your model is bad, but I did not know why it was bad. I just had the result that said you're not aligned. This project said, okay, I know the results are bad going in. My job is to figure out what is the psychological processes that's contributing to that. And I expected it would be one thing. I'm going to tell you what. I expected it would be one thing. No, that was true. The one thing I expected did come out. They couldn't do it. But it was way worse. And the part that was worse was that game vision is not just one vision. It is two subvisions. There's two parts to it. And these two parts partially or nearly entirely explain a lot of the friction that we see on teams, in particular between, let's say, creative people and the business people. I'll do a rough divide for now, then we get into it.
Yeah.
So you've got the people making the product, let's say, and then you've maybe people who are managing the product, for want of a better word. So that was the bit that surprised me the most, is that I did not expect that to come out in this research. So let me backtrack and explain to you why I thought
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no.
Research question one said, what do the models look like? Now, so if I want to see inside your head, I have to do what's called a mental model interview, which is I need to interview you in such a way that I can find not only what's inside your head, but what's not inside your head. I need to find the limits of your knowledge. Where does your knowledge stop? So some technical terms. We all have, people might say you've got a perspective on life. Like people have an outlook. They use these general terms. You see the world the way you want to see the world. In psychology, that's called a frame. A frame is how you see the world. So if I'm interviewing you, for example, and you're a lead designer, you might, and I ask you about your game, you might talk about creativity. So your frame on the game is a creative frame. I see the creative stuff that goes into that game. And all my questions were about creativity. I only wanted to talk about the creative aspects of the game because I thought going in that the part that people can't align on is the player experience of the game. So that was my assumption going in as a researcher saying, I think when I interview you about your game's vision, I think you will talk about A, B, C, and D. And I'll tell you what those are in a second. But I think you will not be able to talk about player experience. So that was my assumption as a researcher going in. And I wrote that out, that here I'm doing this. I'm exploring game vision because I think game creators will have a very difficult time indeed talking about the main reason games exist, player experience. On the last podcast, we talked about Jesse Schell and his book, for example. Nearly all game design books start out by saying games are about experiences. And then they go on to talk about how you design experiences. So we know that we play games for the experience, right? But here's the cognitive dissonance. Could it be that the main reason games fail is also the same reason games exist? So games exist for the player's experience, right? We play games to have an experience. But I think games are failing because the creators cannot define the player experience. Wow, talk about dissonance right away. Hang on, you're telling me that the main reason we're failing is the reason why games are made? That sounds crazy, right? But that's what I'm trying to prove, is that you can't talk about player experience. Yeah. And I think when I ask you these questions, you're going to talk about all this other stuff.
So it's literally, I attempt to create a game with a team, and that, I know that's an experience. And I go in and I say, got it, we're making this experience, except that this experience is actually something I cannot talk about in a way that translates to anybody else.
Correct.
And so I'm attempting to make something that I have shortcutted to be an experience because we know that's what games are. But when, if you were to ask me, what is the experience you're trying to create, I would talk about other things and not that.
100%. So that's what I'm trying to prove.
You mentioned ABCD.
Yeah. So
what's ABCD, if you don't mind going into it? Let me know if I'm jumping.
No, not at all. So at the top of my, so the topic guide is the list of questions you ask to deconstruct people's head. So the first question would be something like, when you think about your game, tell me what you think. So I'm just looking to see what's top of mind, to see if they, it's got different names, like an overarching symbol, like a symbol so powerful that it guides the game. There's these ideas. So I just want to see, when you think about your game, what's the first thing that springs to mind? It's an easy opening question. There's nothing tricky about it. Nearly everybody talked about something visual, so world building. So it could be the art style, a very significant character, an IP they're leveraging, something visual that you can look at, right? They try to paint a picture. And I would say, okay, I can see the world that you're building. It's this IP in this game. They've mentioned the camera. It's a third person narrative, blah, blah, blah. They're painting a picture of what they're making. And I'd say, okay, so what else? What do you do in the game? And then they would talk about features and systems and stuff like that. So they'd say, oh, it's got these systems and you can do these things, like behaviors. I'd say, okay, so now we're working our way down. And I said, what's the player experience? I think question three I asked was, what's the player experience? And this is where the wheels come off the car at this point, really. They're like, oh, the experience, gotcha. Lots of ums and ahs at this point. Most people jump to vague emotions or feelings. That's exciting and it's unique. And it's engaging. It's definitely engaging. Yes, it's fun. Okay. So I say, okay, I see you've jumped to emotions there. What's the actual experience, though? How would the player feel? What would drive them? How are they feeling when they're engaging with the game? Now, obviously, I'm looking for something specific that I'm not revealing. So I keep prodding around this. So there are the three things that come out for A, B, and C. It was only as far as C, by the way. So A was world building. Okay. B was features and systems, stuff, widgets, whatever. And C, when I specifically asked about the player experience, what I was going there to begin with, everyone jumped to either emotions and feelings, which were very vague indeed, or they flat out said, I cannot answer you. Some even said, our studio doesn't talk about that. We do not talk about the player experience or the player in general. That surprised me, by the way.
Wow, that surprises me.
Yeah, they combined them together. They said things like, either the player experience was generic, exciting, engaging, insert whatever word here, doesn't really mean anything. But when it came to the player, they talked a bit longer. They said, well, that's a marketing problem. We just make the game. So some people said things like
that. Oh, my gosh.
So you're starting to see a picture here of not everyone on the team thinks the same way. So first of all, this is clearly not accurate. There's another term for the mental model that if it was good, it would be, they called it, it's called accuracy or high quality. It's got different terms. So what I was trying to do is called leveling. I'm trying to see at what level does your mental model break apart. So I can see they talk about the world building. They can talk about characters, features, camera angle. I can see they talk about emotions in general terms. They're hard to interpret, basically. I can see that they can know what features and systems are building. But I see the level they cannot talk about, and no one could do it, by the way, was the player experience, in any robust way, at least. So I know what they're looking for, right? This is one thing. I was going in saying, if games exist for the player experience, I need to prove that people cannot do that. And not to mention too many academic terms, but I interviewed more people that I needed to hit saturation. Saturation means the same answer just keeps coming back after you interview people again. And I interviewed people of all different sizes. Some of these teams were 1,000 people, some were 500, some were in the hundreds, some were in the tens or 20s. All a full spectrum of different studios around the world, different sizes. And every team, regardless of how many years experience they had, a graduate had the same mental model as someone with 20 years of experience in the game industry. They all thought the same way. We think in terms of world building, systems and features, or vague emotions. And none of them, no exceptions, could describe the actual player experience in a way that makes sense at a psychological or robust level. It was just made up. So made up, I shouldn't use that term. Low quality is maybe a more accurate term. Low quality means if I'm trying to communicate that to someone else on the team, it's not likely to transfer. It's so open to interpretation that it's going to create a problem. What problem? The team is misaligned on the vision. So this is why the team is misaligned on the vision. Nobody is misaligned on the world or the art style or the characters. Nobody is misaligned on the features or widgets that they're building. What they're misaligned on is why they are building those features. So when I was speaking to someone, for example, and we're talking about features and systems, and I took a different approach about player experience, I said, I can see what you're building, but what's the player experience those features and systems deliver that you're implementing? And they said, I don't know. And they said, because I'm meant to make decisions, and if we had a clear vision, the vision's meant to inform decision-making. Like, I can make that feature in 100 different ways. And the vision's meant to tell me which way I implement that feature. Because the vision is not articulated, that's the word I used, and instead it's interpreted or inferred. I have to imagine what it would be. I just make it up what I think is best at the day. But the problem is there's maybe 30 people on that feature, and we all just make it up in our own way. There's no guiding vision that says this feature exists to create this specific player experience. So when you implement it, this is what you're contributing towards. So we're starting to see one of the major outcomes, which is I went in to prove that the mental model is of low quality, and that turned out to be true. In particular, specifically, the low quality comes from the inability to articulate player experience. They all have to guess it. Oh, it's that game over there. Prototype theory, which we talked about last time. Or they ignore the problem completely and say, let's just build something.
Yes.
Features and systems.
The way I described this recently was, we're going to build our way out of the fact that we don't know what our game is.
Exactly.
We hope that someday it will all come together. Just because we have so many pieces, we'll be able to all fit together, and then it'll make a cohesive experience, which is absolutely backwards, actually.
Completely backwards. I keep saying this, I'm not a creativity researcher, but creativity and how it works comes up when you study vision, let's say, ideation. And if I showed you the model that I come up with of how people think, essentially, whenever you work on a design problem, you're meant to define the problem as accurately as possible. So that's called the context. You have to describe the context. And so when I'm interviewing people, I had these boxes pre-drawn. I had this sheet. And when they were talking, I was drawing their mental model as they were talking, essentially. And I wanted to see, are you defining the context, the problem your team is making, or are you defining the form? The form is the solution. Now, widgets and features and systems all fit into the solution. That's all.
Yep.
That's just building something. But again, when I ask them a simple question, why are you building that? Nobody I interviewed could articulate what experience those features were delivering. So when it comes to their context, what are you doing? It was incredibly vague and open to interpretation. And by the way, nearly everybody I interviewed admitted that at some stage. They had to realize, come to their own realization that I cannot answer this guy's questions. And some people who wanted to speak to me thought they were good at game vision. They thought going in, I think I'm good at game vision and holding the vision, so I'm going to talk to this guy to show him how good I am at the vision. But we're in question number three, and it's, I have nothing in my locker. I can't answer your question.
Yeah.
So it's quite uncomfortable for some people.
I was curious, because when you asked question number three, what is the player experience? Part of me was wondering, I was like, if I was anticipating a lot of people returning to question the B question, the stuff. Mm-hmm. Be like, what's the experience? Oh, these features and these systems and these.
That happened.
That's what the player experience. Yeah. And that did? Okay. Yeah. I was curious because I was like, oh man, I feel like so many people would go back to that. This is what I know. Again, like you said, the form, the solution rather than the understanding of the problem.
And because they don't understand the problem, like some people I interviewed, everything's anonymous here, and they all agreed, I'm not going to name any studios or names, that's not important. But some people were saying, we're going to make, our studio's goal is to make the best, let's say, shooter on the market. So we're jumping ahead to some other results here. So they started analyzing competitor analysis by looking at other games on the market. And they made a list of all the features and systems that the other games had, to try and deconstruct what does the best shooter look like. And I said, did that approach work for you? Obviously, I know it doesn't work, but I had to ask the question. I said, does that approach work for you? Did it help you design the best shooter? And they said, no, it didn't explain anything. Just because one game had all these features, it didn't explain at all why it was successful in the market. So they were aware that the model they had doesn't work, but they also didn't have any other model that was better. So we had reached the end of the limits of their knowledge, right? The limits of their knowledge said, the only way I know how to do a competitor analysis to position my game in the market is by looking at systems and features. If I had a better model, I would be using it, but they didn't have it. Again, that's useful for me that when I talk to them, they're revealing how they're thinking, which is essentially what I'm doing. I'm asking their processes, I'm asking all these questions in a cross-functional way. I ask different questions to come at the problem from different angles. And it reveals their thinking, but it reveals the limits of their thinking. And that's the model I construct. So you can see that they're doing all these very basic things, like they're describing their own game in terms of features and systems, but they can't articulate the experience. And then when they try and position their game against others in the market, again, they're back to this very primitive approach of what systems have they got, or what features, and we'll position our games with those. And what I wanted to talk about today really was the problems that I found, because that alone is significant, which is, does the game industry have a problem with game vision? Like the things that we're seeing on a weekly basis, studio closures, staff being laid off, staff saying, feeling burned out, all of those problems come back to game vision. I think I talked about them in the previous episodes as well.
Yep.
If you don't have game vision, that ultimately leads to friction at work. And I'm going to talk about friction in a second. I'll talk about another finding. So the solution's meant to contribute to solving, like, it is the number one problem statistically in the games industry. This is not a problem that's number 10 on the list or further. Yeah. This is number one problem. If you want a high performing team, if you want a successful studio or game, this is the thing you would work on to give yourself the best chance. There is nothing higher. And number two is probably culture, the culture of your studio. Yeah. I know it sounds like a broken record. We talk about it a lot, but that's the way it is. We can't, the data doesn't lie. Sadly. Yes.
I want to dive into this then. So you said that you were shocked. You said that one, you expected to see what you discovered, which is people, their mental model basically breaks down. It disintegrates at a certain point and they can't answer the question. They get stuck. But you said, it sounded like that was one, I expected that. And then, so what was worse?
So what was worse is, I told you that when I was interviewing people, I only asked about creative vision. So all my questions were about your game and the experience, and everything was angled towards that. The shock came from, I asked some people these questions and they said something like, who cares? It's all about the audience, or it's all about the market. So they ignored my creative question entirely. They put the game in a box and shut the lid and went, who cares what that is? That's just a box with a thing in it. It's all about the audience. Can we sell 1 million copies? Or what's a total addressable market? Or someone said, this game only exists to move the company from position A to position B. It's a strategic play. If this game is successful, it'll move us from here to there, whatever here to there was. So even though I specifically...
just to jump in, I know I have worked with and know of many companies that attempt to be, we want to be a AAA studio. So when you went A to B, I was like, that's so, like, we're not quite perceived that way. And if we make this game and it wins, then we will be able to position ourselves as a AAA studio. I'm just bringing that up as an example. Yeah.
So those types of things. So what's surprising about that? I mentioned the word frame earlier. Your frame is how you see the world. My perspective on the world, my frame, and I was going in with the frame of only trying to prove about creative vision. And like I said, it was true that the mental model was of low quality. People could not talk or articulate about player experience. However, what it showed when this second frame appeared, which I ended up calling product vision. So you had creative vision, which is what's the game we're making. And product vision, it was split into two. One was audience and one was market opportunity. So target audience and market opportunity. There were people on the same team who did not want to talk about the game at all or how creative it was or the features or the experience. They didn't even mention features. They didn't even care about that, right? It was just about who is it for or how does that move the company forward or strategic plays, all those types of things. Or positioning, where does it sit in the market? So it shows you that for some people on the same team, I think people have the assumption that we all work the same way. There's a few more technical terms I'm going to explain here. Whenever you try and communicate a vision, there's two things that are actually going on, and one's called the knowledge structure. Knowledge structure is what's the content of the vision. So the features, the systems, the world, the stuff, right? And people have this idea that if I just tell people what's in the vision, that's enough, right? The knowledge, I've told them what it is. Some people I interviewed said things like the creative director would come around and say, I told them what the game was yesterday. Why don't they get it? That just tells me that person has no idea about psychology, because just transferring knowledge, there is no evidence whatsoever that is communication. And the reason is because knowledge by itself is not how we work. The other structure, I give a clue, knowledge structure, the other one's called your belief structure. Your belief structure says, whenever you hear that information, what sticks inside your head? How did you structure that information? So even though I'm hearing the words systems, widgets, world building, player experience, skill trees, narrative, blah, 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 for some people, that they'll encode that in their mind in a certain way. Say you're a game designer. You'll encode that in the creative frame. But if you're in the business side, you'll ignore all that and you will restructure that information. The same information was there, but what you remembered and how you structured it was completely different. You do not have the same worldview because of your belief structure. So you could be sitting beside someone, and I've got a creative view in the world, let's say, and someone else has a product view with different belief structures. And the creative director could come in and tell us both, here's the vision for the game. And he'll think, they were both sitting there and I told them all the knowledge I needed. I've done my job. I've transferred the information 100%. And we both leave that room and we have completely different views on what the game is. Fundamentally different. Our belief structure has overwritten the knowledge structure. It's more powerful. We have heard and encoded completely different bits of information. And that will also help them within. So different people, even within Creative Vision, they will hear different things because of the low quality model. They're interpreting what they think they heard because it wasn't articulated. If it was articulated, you'd have higher accuracy in the transfer. But they cannot do that because I've already told you that they can't do the articulation of player experience. So instead they infer it. It's exciting and that's the novel feature. It's like that game over there. It's like the combat mechanic in that. What does that mean? Who knows? Just we'll generate that ourselves individually. So each person, depending on your belief structure and because of the low quality, is rewriting the game vision all the time. So that's why when I was doing the game vision alignment check in the previous 5 years and I said, no teams aligned. This is all the things that is contributing to that happening. The idea of transmitting knowledge, there's that does not, that's right. Way off the mark.
But there's kind of, go on. Oh yeah, no, go ahead.
I will say, but it's worse than that. So it's even more, I'm going to put a pin there. You go first.
No, there's a thing that emerged, and this was, a lot of these were not scientifically researched. They were just practically done when people were trying to look at software development, not even game development, but software development, and trying to figure out, like, why can't we get, we're writing all these requirements docs, and where's the system shell this, and the system shell that. And what they discovered was, like, it doesn't seem to matter. No matter how specific we try to get, and no matter how much more time we try to spend getting more specific, it only seems to lead to a greater number of opportunities for assumptions that are incorrect to be made. So it's almost like the more specific we get, the more divergent the answer becomes in a sort of counterintuitive way, or at least sort of fractionates all over the place. You just, everything just becomes a mess. And what they, there's this thing that we said, which you have this thing called a user story. Not everybody's a huge fan. Sorry for those out there that aren't. But it was attempting to basically say the user of this, whoever they are, try to specify them to some degree. There's a story they're trying to tell. And what we, instead of saying the system shell or make this feature or build this widget or write this code, it was tell me what the experience is for the user. And so that's why it's called the user story, the story of the user. And one of the things that they learned very quickly, and this is still something people struggle with, whatever you write is a placeholder for a conversation with the person who holds that information. So if I have a user story, someone's written out as a user, some type of user, like as a player, I want to blah, so that blah, the very simple form. And the intention of having this exist is so that we will talk about what that was intended. The interesting thing is many people didn't interpret that way. And then they tried to make user stories that didn't have to be talked about so that they would save time. And of course, you can imagine what would happen based on your research. Instead, you get just a bunch of people going in different directions because we didn't align. But the second, I think, challenge that people saw with this is that as they looked at those user stories, even after they talked with them, still, when you went and built it, it wasn't right. And the person who was setting that vision or holding whatever that user story, like why this is important, they would go, wait, why did you build that? And it's because they said this. And I was like, well, that's not what I meant. We talked about it. It's like, yeah, we talked about it. I built you exactly. And so not only was the text insufficient, the text plus the conversation was insufficient, and the real place you learned if you were aligned or not was only when you actually built the thing. Mm. And then this leads to a set of other things. Try to get to the thing very quickly. So the faster, because then you can actually learn, okay, are we aligned or not? I won't actually know till you produce something. Anyway, what you were saying, but I started to put a pin in what you were saying, but it was just like, it was all of this was jumping out, and this predates so much of how we think about game development.
And games are harder. So you're making
You're
making me think. So I'm not sure if I finished that discussion around. I mentioned these words form and context. So form is what is to be made? What are we making? Context is where the game creators mostly focus. What are we building? But they ignore this, the creative part, which is what is to be made? And because they can't articulate that, they say, let's make a bit of that game and a bit of that game, and we'll combine them together in a novel way. And however, some people on the team said things like, they hired me for my creativity, and then they took it all away. The reason why creativity is meant to be define the question, define the form, is so that you can apply creativity in a surprising way, that if that's the question that needs answered, I can bring my creativity to the table, in fact, we all can, to deliver that vision. That's why you're meant to define the problem. That's why it enables creativity. The game industry has the exact opposite of that. We cannot, or we're very bad at defining what is to be made. So instead, we will answer what is being made. We will produce it to death. And people said things like, we're not very player experience led in our studio. We're production led. So they knew what they'd be making on any day of any week up for the next X years. But I ask a question, what experience does the feature deliver?
Yeah.
They have no idea. They have no idea what that's for.
Yes.
So what I'm mentioning that because not only is, again, this is not just a vision problem. This ties directly to creativity and burnout. People were saying, they hired me because I'm really good at what I do. And then they took it all away from me by telling me exactly what to do that morning. And they several people told stories that I come to work that morning and I'm given what task to do. Make the thing. It's not what do you think should be made. It's make the thing. And they felt their creativity was just, where is the creativity? AI may as well do your job at that point. That was mentioned too.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there's this split. There's two splits here. One is, are you asking me a question and letting me come up with an answer? Which to do that requires a combination of trust and alignment. Both need to be present for that to work. And if I don't have trust or alignment, or worse, don't have trust and I don't have alignment, then this, I can't trust this person and they're not aligned. So I have to tell them exactly what they need to do.
Yeah.
It still doesn't work because unfortunately I can't actually communicate effectively enough without a sufficient model based on what you're saying. But I'm going to try to get them to do exactly what and I'm going to be basically mandating the solution. So that's one split is, are you dealing with a question and are you letting your experts, your creative experts deal with the question, or are you just forcing them into solutions that you've preset? And the second split is something I actually have a different model for. I like your form and context. The way I learned this was the idea of there's an audience perspective and a builder's perspective on whatever it is you're doing. And the role of leadership is to basically, to some extent, define and then maintain connection to the audience perspective up and down the entire organization. So we understand why we're doing what we're doing. The audience's perspective, which again is an experiential lens. It's a value-focused lens. And underneath that, you have a builder's perspective, which is essential for making anything. But it serves the audience perspective. I can't have a game without building this stuff, but the stuff is not the game. The game is what will come out in the audience perspectives.
Exactly.
So anyway, those are two just stuff that's popping up.
Let's go back to that point. So I mentioned, based on what you said, let's bring in audience. I mentioned there's these two subvisions. Going in, I thought I would only be talking about creative vision. And again, quick summary, I intend to prove that the vision was low quality. The mental model was low quality. There's no player experience. Turned out to be true. But then the surprise was, or one of the surprises, people ignored my creative questions and only talked about the product, audience, or market opportunity, or market positioning, and things like that. So when you have these two subvisions, but they're on the same team, right? Whenever you have that, so people have different frames, to get those to be an effective team, you need what's called a bridge. And to create a bridge, you're meant to have, it's called constructs. You're meant to have constructs in common, right? What that means is there should be things in the creative vision that are similar to things that are in the market vision so that these two people can see each other's point of view. Guess what there was none of in the mental model? There was no bridge.
Construct.
So how the product vision people were thinking when they talked about their audience and the market, and how the creative vision people were talking, they would find it very difficult to see each other's point of view, at least from an accurate perspective. And it's even worse than that. We're working our way down how many surprises I got. So that's one thing to say is that first, the second subvision appears, which I didn't expect. So it shows you people are thinking differently on a team. Worse again, there's no bridge. So they find it very difficult to communicate in any meaningful way without very basic things like features again. Oh, you're making a game without features. We'll position it over there. Or your art style's a bit cuter and friendlier. This one's a bit more edgy. Really basic things. Nothing really. They would fit in with appeal or preferences. I like that art style, but they're not the same as player experience. What's the psychological feeling that we know about when a game resonates with you? We know what goes on from my previous player psychology careers. But the game industry's not using that. They're just guessing. So these two people are finding it very difficult to communicate. And I hinted that it's worse again. So in psychology, these two subviews, the creative view and the product view, they operate at different levels, psychological levels. And usually the product view is seen as controlling the creative view because they control the money. They've got more power, essentially. So don't think of these as equal. You've got this power play at hand where people on the same team are thinking in different frames with no common bridge, very hard to communicate. One is a known problem in psychology that it's seen as dominating the other, that the organizational level, the product view, has for decades has been seen as controlling the product view. And even though I did not...
The creative view.
The creative view, sorry, yeah. So product view dominates the creative view. And when I interviewed people, I didn't use all these terms. I was just chatting to them. But people said things like, Oh yeah, management. The word dehumanizing was brought up because they said they just see us as just making a product. We just do the work, but they take all the glory or all the sales or all the rest of it. So they were feeling this. They were aware that this problem that's been known about in psychology for decades, that if you're in a company, let's say the management layer, for want of a better word, and the creative layer, the team layer, there's been known to be tension between those two levels in an organization for decades. And there's people who research that exact problem. What's interesting is I did not ask about it in my interviews, but people talked about it, that there was this animosity from both sides, I would say. So the creative people I talk to, for example, would be quite disparaging towards management. Well, they don't play games, or they don't care what we make. They just see it as a black box and things like that.
This is all about ROI, money.
Exactly. KPIs, blah, blah, blah. So they often see the game as an art. They don't care about the art, essentially. But the business people would say they don't understand the business, that we have to survive and things like that. And so each side had quite a negative. You would like to think they saw the best at each other, but it was often quite negative towards each other, quite a lot of friction. But again,
you're the psychologist. I think it is more normal for people to see the worst than the best, especially if there's not a pre-existing relationship.
It really is. And it explains, I think before we talked about postmortems and sitting in on projects that failed, and this precise problem we're talking about here, that this bridge, either between a developer and a publisher or the creative team and the management team, this bridge exists at different levels, right? But it's a known friction point. And if you can't share or see someone else's point of view, then it's hard to trust them. It's hard to build trust or understand why they're doing what they're doing when you have no common frame of reference. So that was it just kept getting worse and worse, that I went in to prove one thing, that even when talking about the creative aspects of your game, I just thought you couldn't do that, which was true. You can't do that. But then it showed that actually there's people on the team who aren't even thinking about creative at all. They're talking about the market or the player or things like that. And then the other problem was there's no way to bridge. They can't even see each other's point of view. So it means the people on the product side, when I asked them specifically, tell me how you position your game in the market. Because market conditions gets mentioned a lot these days. We couldn't survive on the market conditions. We couldn't find an audience. Games are being closed for that reason. My research would also say that's probably their own fault. The way their mental model, the model they're using to position their game in the market, is exactly the same problem that's stopping the creative team aligning on their vision. They are relying on these surface level factors like features, like world building.
World building feature,
When I asked them, how do you position your game in the market? Nobody said we position by player experience. Nobody. So again, they were missing the thing that I would imagine if I was doing market positioning. I'm not in marketing, by the way. But if I was and somebody asked me, what's the difference between these two games? The last thing I'd be mentioning is features or world building, or that's the easy stuff, right? What I'd be more interested in is what's the player experience. And I think we mentioned before, you could have a first-person shooter that delivers a very similar player experience to a racing game, psychologically. So you could attract that player. And the idea of just going after the same genre or the same features is incredibly crude.
Hey, leaders and game devs, if you love what we do here at Building Better Games, imagine what we could create with your support. By joining our Patreon, you help us bring deeper insights, develop better training, and host more expert discussions to level up your leadership and game development skills. Plus, as a patron, you're going to get exclusive behind-the-scenes content, early access to episodes, and a chance to ask your burning questions directly to us. Join now and help us build better games together. I remember talking about, we mentioned this last time, and I made a post about this, and it was, if you look back through the history, like my history of playing games, and I've done this, so they're like, okay, what games have I played? And so, I like 4X strategy games. I like real-time strategy games. I really like shooters, console shooters back in the day when that was more of a thing. Now everything's cross-platform. All shooters. I'm a big fan of all shooters. And then you like bring up a title, and it's, oh, cool, so you probably, like, you really like shooters, you probably like Quake. And I'm like, I didn't really like Quake. I'm just like, oh, okay. You probably like Counter-Strike, right? You like your shooters. No, I wasn't a huge fan of Counter-Strike.
Exactly that.
Oh, okay. And sometimes you get games that, like, most people don't like. And I'm like, this was the best thing ever. Or people thought that was an okay experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, this is the best thing ever. And it speaks to this. And I remember posting, I've tried 4X games I just didn't like. And again, I can go to this place and I think it would be an arrogant place to go, but I think I used to go there when I was like, it's a bad game. That's why I don't like it. It's a 4X game and I like 4X games and I don't like this one, so it's a bad game. But then you look and you go, wait a minute, tons of people play this.
Yeah.
This is one of the Yeah. Most played 4X games in the world. Well, I just don't like it.
I just don't like it. But
I don't like it.
But we know how to describe it. We can make a more accurate guess at why that might be again. So that's what I was looking for when I interviewed the people, which surprised me, on the product side, which I did not expect to do going in, but that was the result. So off I went and interviewed them with how they did their job. They can't.
And so you found both couldn't describe this. Like,
correct.
So on the creative vision and the product vision,
correct.
We did not have a sufficient accuracy achieved by the time we got to the bottom of it.
Correct.
And with that combined with there being no bridge, plus there being not parity in the visions from a power perspective, where literally the business vision or the product vision, the marketing vision simply rules because those are the people that have the money and set the timeline and have to go get funding if they need more.
Yep.
And by the way, that I think we are, like you said, the creative side is not particularly sympathetic to the challenges of funding a studio. Simultaneously, that marketing side not particularly sympathetic to the challenges of creatively building something, solve the player problem we're trying to solve.
Can you see why I was surprised?
Yeah.
I mean, the problem cool is stuff. Way, it's multiple layers worse than it's I imagined going in. I thought it was really bad going in, and it was way worse than I imagined because of all those layers you just summarized. All of those are at play. And the thing is that these are not the things you get from experience. You don't just, people say, oh, you learn from experience. Spoiler alert, there's some things you do not learn from experience. You need to actually learn it. You do not stumble across this stuff. You do not do mental model interviews in your day-to-day. Okay, let's go in and do a mental model interview in the CEO today and see, or the creative director.
No, I just thought about somebody because I was an engineer by degree, as a computer systems engineer. And so I did some calculus and some fairly advanced calculus and differential equations and things like that. I wasn't great at it, not my strength, but I had to learn it. And I'm just imagining if someone told you as you were growing up, you'll get some experience later and then you'll know how to do calculus. That's not how, the people who invent this stuff, there's a reason we consider them geniuses.
And that is really important. I've seen people on LinkedIn over-indexing on the value of experience. And I'm just like, there's some things you have to understand, you have to do critical thinking to anything like that. What are the limitations of saying something like that? You can get some things by experience, but you need to figure out what can I get from experience and what can I not get from experience. The final question I interviewed, and this is one of them, by the way, as you say, calculus and mostly theoretical frameworks, like stuff we're talking about today, they're not in the ether. They're not sitting on your desk on a Monday morning waiting to be discovered. You need to actually go on. That's why we have the word training or education is there are some things you need to learn. And that is the only way to get that. It is not in the ether. Let's try and prove that. At the very end of my thesis, I turned my attention to this question. And I first of all said, why am I the person spotting this? And I thought it was because of my very specific careers that I've had. I was the founder of a game research studio as a professor of human computer interaction at a university. I was exposed to these models in my day-to-day job, and I realized that was the wrong question. The question isn't, why am I seeing this? The question is, why isn't the game industry seeing this? In other words, if you're the people I interviewed who ultimately had to acknowledge, I can't answer this guy. I cannot answer the question. And they've been 20 years in the industry. Normally, if we're stuck, like you've got an engineering background, you go and try and understand what you don't know. You look up, right?
Yeah.
Why can't I understand this problem? What's previously been done? So what stopped people going and exploring? I'm not going to go into the full psychology behind it, but there is known psychology, especially among experts, that says that restricts them from looking for solutions because they have this idea that I'm an expert. So if there was a solution that existed, surely I would know about it. And this is a known problem in psychology for over half a century, I think, actually, maybe 100 years, that experts have a particular problem that prevents them from seeking out new information. Because they see themselves, it's an identity problem, because they see themselves as experts, surely I would know. Spoiler alert, you don't know. You don't know.
Yeah.
No. So that was the final conclusion. I'm not going to the psychology of that, but that was the thing that...
No, that's awesome. I think for me, I'm just going that idea of the learner's mind, like the student's mind, and it is hard to maintain it. I saw something about diagnoses from medical doctors, and it was, they said that would you rather have, if you had some weird set of condition, like some weird set of symptoms, would you rather have someone fresh out of medical school diagnosing you, some fresh-faced 27-year-old or whatever who's just started and they're kicking things off? Or would you want someone who's been doing it for 20 years, 30 years, seeing a lot of patients? And we default to, oh, I'd want the person who's been doing it for 20, 25, 30 years. But they have seen so many patients over that time that if you actually had a weird combination of symptoms that meant some strange condition, they are less likely to spot it than the person who just came out of medical school where they were taught about these weird symptoms and these different conditions and these different things that came together. And it was to reinforce this point of you have to be taught this, and it fades as you get used to experiences, you get used to norms, and you see a bunch of people, and you're used to, like, you get the doctor who's been doing it a long time, and obviously not all doctors will fall into this trap, but who just, oh, you have a problem with that? Yeah, it's probably this. Don't worry about it. And so maybe you should worry about it, but you're so far removed from training, and your education is now 20, 25, 30 years old. I know that they stay up to date and various things, but
let me build on that. So I'll reinforce what you just said. So that was one factor I mentioned, was experts have a particular known problem with them that they think the solution would be out there. The other thing that's maybe, it's called locomotion, which is speed, basically. The game industry is so busy, there's this social pressure to move forward. So I had to look at social pressure. I'm interested in team performance. So I looked into, is there anything that prevents a team from stopping and reevaluating what's going on? One was one I just mentioned. Another one's this locomotion theory, which says this social pressure to, hey, if I stop, I'm slowing not just me down, I'm slowing the team down. So you're impacting all the people around you. And as social humans, we tend to not want that I'm burdening other people. So you have to acknowledge that this isn't just an individual problem, that the first one I mentioned was an individual problem. Experts have flaws from stopping them being curious, let's say. But then you've got, at the team level, you've got social pressure of locomotion, which is, hey, if I raise the question that I'm not aligned on the vision, I'm impacting 100 people. I am impacting 100 people, or 1,000 people in some cases I interviewed. I can't take the weight of that on my shoulders. I'm going to say nothing. Those two things combined led me to say, if you're trying to solve a problem, there's this idea of single loop and double loop learning. So single loop learning is you keep applying the same thing. You've learned something 20 years ago and you just try and optimize it. And you optimize it to the end of its life, but it's the same idea. It's just a bit better. But eventually it doesn't work. And what you're meant to do is do double loop learning. Double loop learning says we have to question the question. Not refine the question or optimize the method. We have to stop doing that and question why we do that at all. And because of this locomotion thing, because of this social pressure among the team, it's really hard to do. I think we should stop for half a day and question the vision. Are you insane? Yeah,
we don't have time.
We don't have time for that. But that's exactly the thing that has prevented you being successful. Now, that's a team phenomenon. Yes, that's a social pressure.
And you're doing so much more work with so much lower efficacy because you're not taking that. And again, empathy for the devs in this, because some of them have been in places where it felt like all they did was stop all the time. And they were like, we never get to do anything because we're always just stopping and we got to talk about it. And the scrum master made another meeting and the leads say we need to get into the talk about why we're going where we're going. And many of those times, that's not effective conversation. We related to what we were talking about before, that is so difficult to articulate some of this stuff.
So this exact thing came up where someone said, oh, we're good at vision because we iterate it quite a lot. And I had to subtly break it to them that iterating a low quality vision is not actually helping you, because as you say, once you've had the 20th meeting of iterating the vision that no one knows what it is, people get frustrated. Like, why are they doing it again? It didn't work the other 19 times. Why are you? What you don't need is to do it again. You need a better quality model. And again, back to this experience, it is not in the ether. You need to actually learn it. You need a better model.
Yeah.
But that's back to the curiosity factor. You can see these are linked. They should be questioning, hey, if I've repeated this 20 times and we got no better at articulating the vision, would that not suggest that the way we're articulating it is not sufficient for the job in hand? The evidence would say, yes, it's not. We're missing something. So all these problems are connected. You can see how they compound each other.
And again, like curiosity, if you're always busy, curiosity is a hard thing to have. Also, the people that are more prone to the curiosity, and actually, I shouldn't even say prone to curiosity, although that might be true as well. It's the people that are allowed to be curious in a modern corporate environment tend to be the more junior people because they can get away with it. But the experts are going to hesitate to be as curious because they're supposed to already know.
Correct.
even though, to your point, this isn't something you just figure out through experience. No. It's something that is taught, like calculus or advanced music theory. Like, my brother and sister are musicians, mm-hmm. and they both got like a lot of formal musical training. And there's stuff in that a musical theorist will teach you that, like, you can't just go over to a piano and play it for 20 years and figure out. Yeah. You might intuit some of it might make more sense because you played for a while. And I think that's also what I want to call out, is like what you're saying probably resonates and makes sense with many people because they've been in this soup and they're like, these are the pieces that are missing. Yeah. This is what's absent inside of my environment. But unless I'm the junior person, and then the junior person, if I keep bringing this up, I might be viewed as someone who's, oh gosh, another just skeptic or someone who doesn't believe in the vision, or like, why can't you just do the work? We need to just do the work. That's how games industry works. You just got to sit down and do the work.
And that's the bit we need to break, that this idea that I think the game industry is largely seen as a vocational industry. You pick it up as you go. You make a game, you sit beside the experienced people, you learn from them. But as I said at the beginning, the experienced people, their mental model was no different, and in some cases worse. Let's say it's the same as the graduates.
More concrete.
Yeah, it was very similar. There's very little difference between them. So they haven't picked this up in their 20 years of experience. You're maybe in terms of something that you're doing routinely. If you're a 3D modeler and you've done 20 years of 3D modeling and there's a best way of doing it, that's where experience matters for sure. You need to understand what experience is good at and where it does not help you one bit. And as we say, we have to acknowledge the downsides of experts, that they are, because of identity problems, which is a known problem in psychology, experts have problems, but people don't acknowledge that side. They just see more experience is always better, and they don't acknowledge, okay, tell me the three things you know that are likely to trip up an expert. Go on, tell me what. So those are the things they don't discuss. They're not aware of their own limitations even. And they should be listening to the graduate who's fresh in and questioning, hey, can you just tell me why you're doing that? That's probably a very sensible voice. We could talk about voicing in some podcast, how to listen to people, but that's a bit off topic.
Okay, so we have a series of problems. It wasn't just that they can't, with sufficient accuracy, create a creative vision or communicate a creative vision. It was that there are, yes, they couldn't do that. Also, there were two visions. Those visions had no bridges. Mm-hmm. The constructs within both of them could not be connected. And there's a power differential between the two visions where one rules over the other practically, and there's little sympathy for those two groups. Mm-hmm. And this all leading to game developers who are those that are experts who are looked to solve this are as likely to, they don't have an answer and are likely to say, perhaps there is no answer, or don't worry about that, or just do the job. Or this is, it's funny, I'm coming back to, I facilitated a retrospective for a company, a game that had shipped, and it hadn't gone well. It was a critical success, commercial failure.
Okay.
And I was, when you're a facilitator, you're very just, I'm just there, I'm holding mm-hmm. space. I'm trying not to have opinions about what's going on. I gave some opinions to some of the leads later because they were like, oh, can you give us a breakdown of what you saw? I did. But one of the things that shocked me is I'd split everybody into these groups and they were talking about like how the project had gone. And there were some people, very experienced people, who were describing, I've been in the games industry a long time. You know what? We did good work. You were good people to work with. I call that a win. And I was just like, what? The game failed. The studio might shut down.
Mm-hmm. Those people might lose their jobs. They have to move their families across the country.
Yeah. But what do you, like, and again, I get, and there's a part of it where I understand, hey, silver lining.
Yeah, I get
we
it.
We did good work. Yes, you were good people to work with, but whoa.
Where's the organizational learning? Where's the taking, being accountable?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're going to go do this again and just hope you work with good people and do good work? Is that what we expect in the games industry? The experienced people have learned what you do your best job in terms of your craft expertise, try to work with people you like. Games fail, they succeed, most of them fail, that's okay, that's the industry we're in, move on with life, go to a new company, make a new game.
Bear in mind, the senior people, more likely to get a job, more likely financially off, more likely not to lose their job. So let's talk about power here as well, into this mix.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, I remember being, I won't say offended, but I was shocked because that came out of multiple of the groups.
Wow.
And people were just like, yeah, it doesn't always work. And I'm like, wait, but that's why we're here doing a retrospective.
To learn.
Not to go, oh, well, like you said, market conditions, that, you know, or whatever. There's what we're supposed, I will never say you can control everything, but my goodness, try to control the things you can control in terms of causing your game to succeed. And it just felt like this perhaps understandable, complete just alleviation of responsibility for what had just happened. And again, like you said, lack of organizational learning, lack of, wait a minute, how do we do this better next time?
Yeah. I'm shocked at the lack of organizational learning. Can't give any stories, obviously, but very similar to what you just said. Games failing, asked to see a report, what did you learn, something like that. They're like, ah, we'll do better next time. There's no learning. Yeah. There's no learning here. And they don't even take a learning.
Oh, man, this one's fat, because I did that retro for a company when I was in there. I've also at one point set up a series for a major project, and it was inside a company, and there were like a set of, there's always, every company will always have a few things that are really important. Mm. Often those things are, like any other project, fraught with peril and failure and struggle, but a lot of these had gone out and they'd shipped, and either successfully or unsuccessfully things had happened. And what we discovered, because I talked with other people who had done other retrospectives on the other like high priority projects, and we all, it wasn't that, oh, nothing we could do, but what happened was we would learn all these things in these retrospectives, and then we wouldn't do anything with them.
Correct.
And very then cool. We'd run another big project, and we'd get to the end, and they would have, it was shocking how similar the outcomes were.
Surprising, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like, you're going to be like, oh yeah, I ran the retro on this last big important project that was fraught with struggle and all this different stuff. And yeah, those were our four major takeaways too. And you're like, wait, these four takeaways? Yeah, those four takeaways, like it was this and this.
Trip this up again.
And it was like, oh my gosh. And then, and you go talk to it's like every single time it was the same thing. It's like, wait, why are we're supposed to be learning and growing and improving? And it's, yeah, but we're all so busy. There's the next thing. We're just going to roll into it. And
this is taking a wider view of the findings of that. It's not just about vision. Like vision, it is the leading predictor, but we need to tie that, as you said, the culture, which is part of what we're talking about here, which is why do we have no culture? You can have a culture of anything. You could design your culture to be a culture of learning, which would automatically probably give you a culture of resilience. And if they were important to you, that we're building a studio, it's going to last 20 years, how are you going to do that? We're going to align on culture. We're going to do organizational learning to make us resilient. If we're aligned on the vision and we have a culture of learning, we'll probably have a resilient culture. I'm making some assumptions here, but that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm always stopping from saying something controversial. Is the industry professional? Because it sounds to me like they're winging it a lot of the time.
Yeah. But I would say that I think it's okay to say that and still accept, because I'll be honest, I've worked out of the games industry.
Yeah.
It's not like they're any better. Like somebody else has this solved. It's sometimes there's a different type of work being done that's a little bit more predictable. Like when I worked at a grocery store, it's, hey, this is a known system and it functions. But it is the broad, are we like thinking about culture in the right way? Are we thinking about vision in the right way?
What I mean,
I
interrupted. Please go on.
Oh, that was, it's just, I think it's okay to say we are both a professional industry in the same way that many others are. And we have a very difficult problem set. And we haven't. I think anybody who says we've solved it, I'm like, no, you haven't, because I don't know anybody that can predict which games are going to succeed and which are going to fail.
No, that's very difficult.
From within the studio or outside of it.
But isn't the fact that we've got a difficult problem set, I think that's the way you described, the fact that we're in a difficult domain, shouldn't that mean we put extra emphasis on all the things we've talked about tonight?
There's a comfort factor that I always wonder about, right? How, one of the things I think about a lot as a leader and as somebody who tries to teach leaders and think about leadership is, how much uncertainty is there in the system and how are you dealing with it? And in game development, even if you're making a sequel, but especially if you're doing something like novel, there's a massive amount of uncertainty in the system. How are you dealing with it? And one of the most common ways humans deal with uncertainty is to wall it off from themselves. And you go back to like tribes of people building literal walls to keep predators out in a way like, no, I don't want to deal with that, so I'm going to build a wall. But in so many ways, we do that individually, we do that as teams, we do that as companies.
I've seen that.
I don't want to deal with the uncertainty. Now, part of that is like there's an infinity of uncertainty out there, and there's some of it that we just don't want to deal with, and that's okay. But unfortunately, if you don't go out and explore it, if you don't go out and find out what's in some of that uncertainty, then you will not have the information and the resources that you need to succeed. However, going into the uncertain is very uncomfortable. And so when you're describing this, it's like, why aren't we doing this? I just come back to this idea of, because it's so much, I can just stay where I'm comfortable. I can keep being the best expert at VFX or production or QA or design. I'm just going to keep, I'm going to narrow in and focus on that, and I'm going to do great work.
I even touched on that in my dissertation. Like, what stops people doing this? And it's back to identity and experts as well. So there was a paper around, if you have a success, it is more likely your next project will be a failure. And the reason is that the reason is that success affects your identity. You're now seen as successful. So the things that you do to create the next hit, you're more likely to look backwards at what made you successful rather than accurately understanding the circumstances you're in. And that's a this is why you have this somebody who's got a hit, and then we hire that person to make the next game. But what they're likely to do is repeat the past, not innovate in the future, because they've got this identity problem now, which is, oh, you were successful. And that's a nice feeling for a lot of people. I like feeling successful and powerful and getting all this money and buying a yacht. So I think I'll just keep doing. So I'm just going to repeat what made me successful in the past. Does that work today?
Right.
Nope. Probably not.
Yeah. You need... World has changed. Players have moved on.
So this is the psychology. One of the other problems of being an expert, in addition to the one I mentioned earlier. So again, all these issues are...
By the way, I'm going to kick in. My goodness, doesn't that just drive a spike through the heart of how so many VCs and publishers attempt to select teams?
They're asking the wrong questions.
They were successful. They were just successful. They just came from that successful company. They must know what success
Clearly,
looks like.
They can do as it again.
As if success was somehow like attached to just repeating whatever was done. Oh my
if
goodness.
That worked, then we would know that by now. If that approach worked, people would be getting rich routinely on a weekly basis, and it doesn't happen.
And you and I talked about, too, that this that almost every large game studio out there or publishing company out there, they've tried to assemble the team of nothing but the best.
Doesn't work.
Like, we're going to take all the best experts, the craft experts, the blah, 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 the best producers, the best, and we're going to shove them all in a team together, and they're the best. They've got to make a
awesome
game.
It's got to work. It's got to work.
Yeah. And what's interesting is, to me, not only is it not working, it almost seems like it has a higher failure rate.
Very likely, because of the issues. Each of those experts have their own identity problems. They're going back and saying, well, what made me successful in the past?
Yeah.
And not being curious.
And especially if they all have a bunch of different past experiences,
exactly,
too, because then they all clash simultaneously and they're not necessarily that interested in learning from each other.
Yeah, good. This idea of focusing on, we were talking before, the idea of focusing on someone's ability as a metric of building a good team is insane. There's very little research that would support that idea. It's weak at best. But the bonds between the team, the vision and the culture.
Yeah.
I've been looking at this problem, say, I research vision on successful teams. That's my thing. And guess what's top of the list? In nearly every single, either vision's number one or culture's number one. It's usually vision. But in some cases, like the Google one, the culture came first. But it's the same. Yeah. What does not come up is how many ninjas and rock stars and gurus.
Yeah.
That never
comes
up.
How many widgets you managed to build? We managed to build a lot of widgets. Yeah. That was the why we succeeded. No.
No, never come up, surprisingly. Just hasn't been mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we've hit a bunch of different things here. Let's see. We've talked about a series of problems. What haven't we hit?
So there's one major thing we haven't hit. And that's why I'm teasing part four, which is obviously when I saw all these problems, I also went into this with a better model. I knew what should be there, right? I knew what the player experience, I knew one form of how to articulate the player experience, let's say. So that's what when I say people's game creators' mental models are low quality, one way of assessing the quality of a model is comparing it to another one. The other one in this case was mine. I'm saying this is what psychology knows about player experience. And this is how you could articulate it if you wanted, if you knew about calculus, if you knew about, obviously it's not calculus, but if you were trained on what, this is what you would put in the box because you know how people work. So that's what we're not talking about today is, well, now we've seen all the problems, all the different layers of problems, what would a more accurate model look like? What would help the game industry be aligned on a vision and help this friction between publisher or co-dev or product vision and creative vision? That's the book I'm going to write in 2025 is, I'm going to call it Game Vision. I'm going to try and be as straight as possible. So that's my job. And that's the bit we're not talking about. But I hope in about 8 months' time, I can come back and we'll just, it'll all come out. No, this is...
No, I'm loving it. And I'm looking forward to that. Just the highlighting of the problems, I think, and even that idea of... You said something earlier, which is when we... Okay, there's a phrase. Insanity is trying the same thing over and over. Or sorry,
expecting
what is it?
The different result. Over and over, expecting a different
result. Doing the same thing over and expecting a different result. And actually, for me, I go, no, that is actually fairly normal human behavior. In many areas of life, many of us do the same things over and expect a different result or hope for a different result and get frustrated when it doesn't happen. Yeah. We're like, something's wrong with the world because it didn't give me a different result, even though I have no history to support that it should. But there's something that if instead, when we were doing that same thing over and over, the thing I would perhaps ask people to do out there is stop for a second, take the day to think about the vision, and allow yourself to be curious about what you're not articulating or what you're not aligned around, and try to focus on that. Even thinking about this idea of, wait a minute, what is the product vision or business vision or marketing vision? What's the creative vision? How do those things relate? Do they? Do we know how? How do I get the right people in the room who think about those two separate things and talk through it? Because we'll wait for the book and we'll wait for the next episode around a lot of that stuff to go in more detail. But as we're talking about these problems, one of the things that comes to me is what we were talking about at the end. Curiosity, learning. How can you stop being the expert who's supposed to know and so is not curious and start going, maybe this is a solvable problem, and the answer isn't just, I don't know, that's how it is, keep building stuff.
Exactly that. I would invite people, if I was to give some homework, as you say, try and spot this in your own studio. Go and speak to someone in the opposite frame as you even, which is, so if you're in creative vision, go and speak to someone in product vision. So someone in marketing or new audience sizing or something like that. And see how, ask them to describe the game you're working on together. You're on the same team, right? And you've got your idea, even write it down beforehand. Ask them what the game is as well, or how they think about the game. Just to introduce this idea that there are people on the team who don't see it the way you do. That by itself, just realizing, okay, we're on the same team, but we do not think alike. We were in the same room when the creative director talked about the vision, but we did not encode in our minds the same thing. We are thinking differently. Why is that? That's enough. Even to reduce the friction, knowing that people don't see the world as you do, that is enough just to start loosening the bolts and saying, okay, that's interesting. I thought it was just they didn't like me, or they don't like my department, or they don't like creative people. But the truth is, they've got a different belief structure. They just see the world differently than I do, probably because of their job and their background. And that's just the way we are. That's useful to know. They're not my enemy. They're just different. We're all different. So seeing these things, and as you say, even if you're on the creative vision, if someone's talking about the vision and you hear this ambiguous language, it's an exciting, novel, unique, just say, how do I implement? What do you mean? What does that mean for the player? How should the player feel at that point? What words do you think of? There's some words we didn't get to mention tonight, sense-making and sense-giving. Whenever you come up with an idea, it's called sense-making. So if you're the creative director for the game, you're the person responsible for the coming up with the idea, let's say. The quality of the idea that you have depends on the quality of the mental model you have. Because when you get an idea, you're using what you already know to form the idea. So here's one of the final things I'll leave, which is why do we have so many similar game ideas? My results would say that we have so many similar game ideas like Fast Follows or Clones because the mental model is exactly the same. Everybody I interviewed had the same mental model. They're using the same things to define their game. So it means when they come up with the idea for a new game, the model they're using is the same model that we all use. It's not more better or accurate. And at the end of my dissertation, I was suggesting, by the way, if you had a better mental model, if I showed you what it could look like, the chances are you would have better, more creative ideas too. Then sense giving is you would be able to tell that more accurately to the rest of the team who would implement the more creative ideas. So this is leaving on a hopeful note by saying the game industry is in a really bad place. Not only staff are burned out, but players are also burned out from the same ideas just coming. Another one of those, really? Do we need another one again? Why do we have that? That's asked the interesting psychological question. Why do we have the same ideas? My research would say, guess what? You all have the same mental model, and your mental model is directly tied to creativity. The quality of the idea you have depends on how you think. You all think the same way. You need a better mental model if you want to be more creative. But you don't have it.
And there's so one, we can look forward to that next conversation and also to your book. I'm definitely looking forward to it. So
I'll send you a copy.
even if you are that really experienced game producer or game designer or whatever, artist, somebody, or you're fresh out of college or just a graduate, don't beat yourself up that you don't know this. Mm-hmm. What Graham is also saying mm-hmm. is it's okay. You've never been taught this and nobody even knows how to teach this. It's going to involve going outside of what you know, going outside of perhaps the people that you talk to and really being curious and exploring, and don't beat yourself up that you don't know it right now. You mentioned the word friction twice and we didn't define it, and you said that was something that was important as a problem. What do you think?
Let's talk about friction first of all. I can't remember exactly what context I mentioned it, but it was probably in multiple ways. So what is the friction where, on the creative vision, there's friction in terms of people don't know how to implement what they've been told to do. So that the creative director comes around and says, we're going to do this, but they don't know exactly how to implement it. So they feel slowed down because they don't know what direction to go in. They're feeling friction in production. I could make it this way. And they agonize over which way do I make the feature. The vision was meant to help guide me over which it should smooth the path. But the vision wasn't accurate enough. So maybe I prototype it this way. So they end up slowing down production by experimenting. So that was one form of friction I think I was talking about. The other one was mainly psychological friction, which is people arguing. And yeah. So the two subvisions, when there's no bridge between them and this animosity that kind of, you know, emerges between the groups. That's another type of friction, is people are just finding it very unpleasant to be at work and to talk to each other because of lack of trust, lack of how they see each other, lack of respect. And that's a downward spiral. It's very hard to recover from that because the vision doesn't get better over time. It usually degrades over time. So you've got, that happening.
When I look at the games industry, this is an oversimplification, but imagine you have your board or publishers or stakeholders, whatever, the people who control the money, whoever's investing in your studio, and there's often friction between those people and the senior most layer of an organization. There's a struggle there because there's slightly different goals often. Even though that senior layer of an organization is the most aligned with that publishing group, there can still be an animosity and a struggle. And by the way, I think that happens even when they're acting as though they're on great terms. There's a lot of pretending. No, the publisher's great. No, the VC.
It's all good.
Like, you have to say that. You have to say that, because if you go out and you say they totally suck, then you're dead.
Exactly,
you
know, that.
They're not going to work with you again. So there's stuff you can't say. And even if you really believe it, you believe it's going well, the reality is that there's friction because you do have those disparate goals and there haven't been bridges formed between them. And then you have a second layer, which is, and this can be actually more than one break, but between the senior layers of an organization, the people actually doing the work, and there's where you see that they don't understand what it's like to be down here. And in the other way, they don't understand what it's like to try to keep this company afloat. Mm-hmm. You know, both of those things lead to that retreat to the familiar, which is not just I'll go focus on my craft and my expertise. It's also I'm going to go hang out with the people that are like me, that agree with me about this. Yeah. It's one of the reasons, like, complaining and whining without that being well expressed as feedback in some way is so toxic to organizations, because it deepens the divide. And
the amount of times the word silos was mentioned in my mental model interviews, where people, again, I didn't ask about it. I'm talking about, my questions are all about the creative aspects of your game, but it quickly got into the psychology of the team, which is we don't talk to them, they don't understand, friction, arguments.
Did you see that between layers or between disciplines, or both?
Both. I think it happened in multiple ways, even between VCs and things. So someone told a story where, as you say, the VC gives out the money, right? And they told the VC what they wanted to hear. Now, they knew they couldn't make that game, and that wasn't the game they really wanted to pitch. But they said it because I think what happened was they said something like, they told the vision for the game, and the VC interpreted the vision in a different way. And they said, oh, it's blah, blah, blah. And they were like, well, it's nothing like blah, 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 but if that's what gets the money. So they said, yes, it's exactly like that game. And they were like, that was a really successful game. So if that's the vision. So this is an interpretation and vision thing, right? They still said the vision. The VC interpreted that in a different way, but in an excited way. So the developer said, yeah, that's a bit like that game.
Wow.
During development, they realized that there's no way they can make that game. And it was a downward spiral from there. And it's a very negative. I'm obviously not going to reveal any details, but it doesn't end well, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So you've got tensions, you've got power play, you've got interpretations of vision, you've got trust breaking down because you promised one thing and it quickly realized over time they can't deliver that. And all of this because of a misinterpretation where they said, this is what we're making, and someone latched onto a different idea. If that had been articulated clearly, then you would have known up front, either this is that or not.
Also worth pointing out that had they been, even in a mental model, psychologically, if they'd acted as though they were more peers rather than hierarchical, more likely that we would have said, no, that's not what we were talking about.
They should have said that, obviously. Yeah.
But they didn't. And part of that is this.
Yeah, it's exactly that.
You know, you've got the resources I need, so I'm going to say what I'm supposed to say to get the money.
Over the long term, it doesn't work out because that, that's not a negative.
No, you know? Yeah, it's that thing of, what is it? You tell the truth. You got to just,
who would have thought?
If all else fails, tell the truth. Tell the truth as much as you can in those situations. Okay, last thing. Before we started recording, I had talked to you about, I had a really cool interview with Greg Gladstone and John O'Brien. They were working on Baldur's Gate 3, like through a significant chunk of its development. And they were in world building and animation, and I talked to them a lot because Baldur's Gate 3 was this game that broke expectations everywhere, and not just for players with all that you were able to do and just how big and cool the world was. And I played through that whole thing twice, and I don't have time for that. I got two small children, but it's a phenomenal game. And I remember devs saying stuff like, how did they do this? And so it was interesting. I talked to them not just about world building and the pipelines and things like that, but what was this like? How did you hold this in your head? And they talked about Sven, who was the leader of the studio, the leader of the game. Mm-hmm. And they described how they interacted with him. It wasn't as if the whole game was in Sven's head, it sounded like. He had an idea for what he was trying to do. And they actually said he had this real gift of almost blanking his mind and being like a player who'd never seen the game. And so he would go into a play test for something and he was just able to like blank and just become a player who'd never touched the game before, even though this was his job, right? Yeah. This he's doing all the time. But he had this gift of that, and they were like, it was so cool to see. And another thing that came up was he had a way of articulating the principles about why this was important and how he wanted it to look and feel, but not in a way that was every little detail and I'm micromanaging you and I'm breaking down every little asset you need to build. To the point where they were actually excited to show stuff to Sven and hoped to surprise him positively. They wanted to go into a review with him and to be like, okay, we did this, and to see Sven laugh or be like, that's really cool. Because he wasn't actually defining the solution like we talked about earlier. He was stating he was giving them the problem, and he was defining the space to play in.
So he's playing in, he's describing the context. He's saying, this is the space you can play in. And I'm going to tell you the limitations and the boundaries probably of where you can play. How we play, the forms, that's your job as the creator. So it sounds, by the way, that context and form is from Christopher Alexander. If anybody wants to look it up, you'll find that work. And there's different people with different terms, but the idea is the same. For creativity at the team level, not the individual level, it's maybe a bit different, but you want to define the context. And it sounds like that's exactly what he's done, which is, this is where we're playing. What is to be made? How we make that? Over to you. That's your creativity. I can't be 100 or 200 people and apply all the creativity in each area, but I can direct you. I can tell you what the context looks like. That's what should happen. Why don't studios do more of that? And you say, maybe we just get people like Sven who are intuitively, maybe they do come from a design background. Maybe they do read the work of Christopher Alexander or people like that who understand what it means to build a creative team. But if you don't understand that, you go back to what you know, which is, I'll just tell people to make a thing. I'll get a nice Gantt chart and we'll make systems. Yep. And that's the other end of creativity. That ruins everything. But most of the game industry is like that. Not
that. Yes. Oh my goodness. I'm fighting it all the time. There's for leaders out there, and this is a podcast for leaders in game development, although many others are welcome to enjoy it, but that's really who we're targeting. That idea of how do I set the constraints? How do I create the sandbox? Like we've heard all these things, but often when it comes down to day-to-day work, we go back to what we know, and what we know is to dictate and to know this is the solution. And we do that as experts. I think we do that as leaders, instead of saying, okay, how do we define a problem so that our amazing people can solve within that
space? As you say, don't want people to beat themselves up too much, because this is not taught in school. This mental model, this way of thinking, this defining the context accurately, is not taught in game design schools. It's just not been done. And there's, like I say, there's no previous research that I could find. How do game creators think? It doesn't exist. So again, until this year or next year, but so don't beat yourself up too much. Help us on the way, I hope. But it sounds like Sven's got really close. I think if I was to show him my model. He might be interested because it would help articulate player experience specifically. I think he's done a very good job, obviously, of defining the majority of the solution, which is defining the problem. He's obviously got a clear vision of it. And he hasn't touched the solution, so fair credit to him for doing that. He hasn't strayed into the, and we're going to solve it by combat and all these characters and voicing. And he said, here's what I imagine. But how that's going to be implemented, wow, over to you.
That's up to you. That's up to you. That's so cool. All right. I think I want to give you the chance. Anything I should have asked you that I didn't? Anything else that we need to cover?
I don't think so. I think we've touched on every major finding. You did a very good summary of the major findings, by the way.
Okay, cool.
So thanks for doing that. Like I say, part four, if we talk in the future, it'll be the final model. It's called the referent model or expert model. I don't like the term expert, so I use the other model. A referent or reference model, which is how should we do it? So that'll be the final part of the conversation. I would love the book to be ready by then.
Yeah.
But we shall see.
Anything I can do to help. Anything you want to plug?
I think my website is the best place. So any updates on the Game Vision book will be on my website, which is just my name, grahammcallister.com. Just out of interest, my first book, which will be on Amazon next week, this is the not-for-resale copy, is on player psychology, so usability playtesting. This is my previous career. So this will be on Amazon. And I only wrote that book to make all the mistakes with this one, because the book I really want to write was Game Vision. So the only reason I wrote this was to make sure I didn't mess up the book I really cared about, which, not that I don't care about this, but anyway. So the full book is on my website for free. If you don't want to buy a Kindle or a physical copy, the full version is on has been there for 2 years already. But the game and updates on the Game Vision book, I will maybe put the table of contents or things I'm thinking about. Anyway, that's the only thing I would want to say. And there's a contact form.
Perfect.
If anybody has a Game Vision story that they would like to share with me or tell me, there's a contact form. You can just email me and I'd love to talk to you about. I can't stop thinking about this, obviously. It's the only question I work on is Game Vision. So
that's awesome.
I can't get enough.
I'm glad you're doing it. I'm so glad you're doing it because it is important for our industry. And
I think so.
I think a lot of times people are looking at like macro factors and the big economic blah, 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 and this and that and the other. And I do look at it and I go, I think I really, truly believe that we as leaders and developers, yes, there will always be those big things. We can be doing better.
Yes.
And there are things inside of our power to improve. And I'm just glad you're exploring the space to give people more options there. So
I'm glad you're raising this. Without your voice, without your podcast, this would not get out there. So what you're doing is just informing a large percentage of the industry and saying, we need to talk about these things. I still think you were the first person I heard talking about vision and culture in the game industry. Everybody else is talking about how to build a game, the technical side. And you come along and go, there's not much evidence for that. Isn't it really about vision and culture? I say, that's what the science would say for the last 50 years is effective teams are about vision and culture. But you were the first person I heard in the game industry to actually say those words. I think I dropped you an email saying, thank God you're talking about this. Or thank you.
Well, I think you might. Yeah. No, thank you. I appreciate that. And again, I'm glad you're out there doing the actual, I know, not from experience, but I know that the academic research side of this is not straightforward or easy, and it's not a path to your own yacht. So I appreciate very much what you do, and I am very excited for work.
Thanks for saying that.
Thank you.
Ben, thanks for inviting me back on for part three, and I'll see you for part
looking forward to part four.
The final part, the final installment. It's coming. Thanks, everyone.
Okay, I just want to recap everything we talked about as best I can. There was so much there. I really love this episode. So, let's get into it. First, creating a game vision is not simple, and even those that think they are good at it struggle when asked very simple questions. Let's dive into some of the reasons. A. While we are able to do some basic world building and talk about features, often as game devs, as soon as we try to describe the player experience, things break down. Our ability to communicate the most important part of what we do and why people will play our game is lost as different people go in different directions. B. Our inability to communicate the experience clearly is a problem of mental models. Most game devs, regardless of their experience, have a similar model that does not provide sufficient accuracy to communicate game vision. C. The lack of accuracy in our mental models around game vision mean that even if we communicate them and think we've done our job, odds are, everyone we've just talked to has walked away with a different idea of what we want. D. There's not just one vision. Two visions, one focused on the creative side and one focused on the business side, as I would say, or as Graham said, the product side, emerged. On both sides, the constructs to create accuracy are absent. And worse, there aren't bridges to help the different perspectives on a game understand each other. E. There is a power imbalance between the creative and business side of games, with the business side running the show since they control the money. That makes it even harder to communicate across the divide and causes an us versus them to emerge, and we see this across our industry. F. With all this failure to align to a shared game vision, we can't trust each other, and the people who have power attempt to control others to get the outcomes they want, stifling the creativity of their devs. So that's all about the idea of vision. Let's hit some other things that were discussed. Second thing, some things won't be learned through experience. Like calculus and advanced musical theory, most people will need to be taught how to do many things in life. Game vision and communicating game vision are more like that than something you're likely to just pick up as you go. Third, experience is not correlated with success in games. Neither is recent success. In fact, a recent success may cause a higher chance of failure as individuals attempt to replicate their past rather than move into the future. Fourth, the two biggest problems facing game developers, and probably many other fields as well, are vision and culture. Leaders need to invest time and remain curious about these things. It's how you win. Fifth and last, some things you can do regarding game vision today. First, give yourself time to think about it, and then go talk to someone in a different role than you about what they think the game's vision is. All right, I hope you got a lot out of that. Thanks for listening. Until next time.